This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to tonight's edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, we're going to be talking with James A. Willis. He is the founder-director of the Ghosts of Ohio, and he's not just a ghost hunter. He has some other interesting stuff, and only about half this conversation deals with ghosts. The rest of it deals with all kinds of other stuff, from cryptids to just weird encounters. I really enjoyed doing this interview. We did it last Wednesday. And about halfway through, we inserted an EVP that wasn't part of the original interview. I didn't think of asking him for it till afterwards. So that you're going to hear in the middle of the interview. And other than that, enjoy my conversation with James Willis. And so my guest tonight is James Willis. And you have a bunch of books you've written. You have a couple of websites. And your primary focus is on ghosts, but you do delve into some other stuff here and there.
That is true, yeah. I just am a connoisseur of all things strange and spooky, as it were.
And when did you first get interested in this stuff?
It probably sounds really cliche, but I've probably been interested in it in all of my life. The running joke in my family is that my sister, and I've yet to see it firsthand, but she tells the story that when I came home from first grade and we had to write down like what we wanted to be when we were going to grow up, you know, and most people said policeman or fireman, things like that. But apparently I wrote down I wanted to be a scientist so I could find the Loch Ness Monster. So,
nice.
So I guess I was weird from the very beginning, but I kind of was always interested in that stuff. Right around the mid 80s was when I first started getting involved with I guess you'd call them somewhat organized ghost organizations. And then in the mid-90s is when I officially joined the American Ghost Society. And, you know, really it kind of took off from there. And then when I moved to Ohio in the spring of 99 is when I started the Ghosts of Ohio. And we've been running strong ever since and got... we currently now have three divisions or ghost outposts, since that sounds cooler, but we're headquartered in Columbus, and then we have a division in Cleveland and Cincinnati, and we just kind of spread out across the state. So, yeah, pretty much to answer your question, my entire life, I guess.
All right. And you said you grew up in the Hudson Valley.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, a little town called Monroe in Orange County. But so grew up in the shadow of Tarrytown, the setting for the legend of Sleepy Hollow. So that's, I think, kind of aided or kind of twisted me in a strange way.
Did you ever look into the legend to see if there's anything to it?
Oh, definitely. As a matter of fact, you know, I tell people that that's what kind of really got me going down the path, because for our third grade class trip, we went out to Tarrytown and I had a teacher who was a little twisted, who tried to convince us that the story was true. And what she did, which, you know, gosh, I mean, it was kind of cool looking back, is she took us out to like the Tarrytown Cemetery and pointed out the graves that had the characters' names on it. And she used that to kind of promote the idea that the story was true. When I found out later that, well, no, Washington Irving, I guess you could say, borrowed the names of the characters from the tombstones, as well as the setting for Tarrytown. So basically he made it up. That led me at an early age to kind of ponder that, you know, age old question. Okay, well, this story obviously isn't true, but what are the true ghost stories? So even though she was just kind of messing with our heads, she sent me down a path that I'm still walking down today.
Nice. And you said you've written how many books?
Between writing and co-authoring, I think I'm at 14. I'm definitely in a baker's dozen area. I've actually lost count. Once I got off the using all my fingers, I lost count. But roughly around a dozen, I believe it's 14.
And you started with the Weird Ohio and stuff like that?
Yeah. I was approached by Mark and Mark, the two weird guys out of Weird New Jersey. And they had just published the first book in the series, which was Weird New Jersey. And then they had decided, wow, this book is a hit. You know, there's 49 of the weird states out there. So they decided they were going to put out a book, Weird U.S., and they were looking for writers from the different states to just go looking for weird stuff. And for better or worse, when they typed in Weird Ohio, they were getting me with the Ghost of Ohio. So they asked me to contribute some stories to Weird U.S., and those stories went over really well. So that led to Weird Ohio, Weird Indiana, and roughly, I think, about six titles in the Weird U.S. series that I've been involved with.
Okay. And you have two sites. You have the Ghost of Ohio, which is your ghost hunting site.
Yes.
And you have The Strange and Spooky World of James A. Willis.
Yes. The running gag there is my wife always says it's his strange and spooky world, but I get to live in it, because that was kind of the, as I think I mentioned to you, I think being normal is just really boring. And so I'm just into all sorts of weird things. And so they weren't things that definitely fit within the realm of the ghost group, Ghosts of Ohio, because that group is really for, private citizens and companies who think they might have a ghost in their house. They can contact us. So those people really didn't want to come to a ghost site and see things about, Bigfoot, and, Ohio is very infamous for having a cryptid known as the Loveland Frog or the Melon Heads. They've got these weird creatures. So The Strange and Spooky World just started. It's basically a blog that's grown and grown in size. I mean, I don't know how many pages are in there now, of just weird things. There's sections on just stuff that I'm kind of into, which is out there. I mean, all the way down to, the longstanding urban legend that Paul McCartney was killed in a car crash and replaced by a double. So there's stuff about that. You name it, if it's strange and spooky, it's hiding in those pages.
Tell us about those first two cryptids. I hadn't heard of either of them, actually.
Yeah, they are totally cool because, again, it's something that, having lived in different states, what I love about Ohio is that it's got, the standard sort of Bigfoot sightings. We have a couple of lake monsters and those sort of things. But they've got a couple of cryptids that are just totally unique to the state. And the one that everybody points to, which I love, is the Loveland Frog. And Ohio's a weird state, but we're not really creative with our names. So if you don't know where something is located, it's usually in the title. So the Loveland Frog is in Loveland, Ohio, which is right outside of Cincinnati. So it's down in the southern part of the state. But beginning in the very early 70s, there were reports of people encountering this, what could only be described as like a half man, half frog creature, about 6 foot tall. And to me, what's really interesting, other than the fact that, that's really cool, it's 6 foot tall, half man, half frog thing. But the first two reports came in roughly a week apart. And what I find just so fascinating about that is that both of those reports were by police officers. So you've kind of all of a sudden now got this air of validity that comes into play, especially since the one officer actually shot at it and had to file a report. The story that he told, which I love telling little kids because it just freaks them out, is that he was driving along a road that cuts right outside there, the Little Miami River, and he was driving along on the outskirts of Loveland in the middle of the night, and he came around a corner and he saw this dark shape laying in the road. And he said that he thought like somebody hit a dog or a deer. And so he left the lights on, but he parked the car on the side, on the road. And he got out to like drag the deer or whatever, he thought it was, the dead animal, out of the way. Right. And he said at that point, this thing stood up and came at him. And so he shot at it. And he said that he thought that he hit it, but he saw it jump the guardrail and he heard a big splash, kind of like knocked through the underbrush and then jumped into the water. And that was it.
That was it.
Yeah, they found things that they thought might have been scratch marks alongside of the railing, but, you know, that was it. You know, some people have claimed that they continually see it from time to time, but it's just become this gigantic urban legend sort of thing that's kind of grown in epic proportions. And it is a rather unique cryptid, not only to Ohio, but to the world, basically.
Yeah. What was the other one you mentioned there?
The other one is the Melon Heads, which are really kind of cool. And again, what I've become so fascinated with is I totally dig urban legends because I love trying to dig for that little kernel of truth. The Melon Heads are interesting in that the story I'm going to tell you is unique to Ohio. There are Melon Heads stories in Michigan as well as in Connecticut. And so I just love trying to track the story down to see, you know, if, put it any other way, but which Melon Head came first. But but the Melon Head story in Ohio, and like all great urban legends, you know, it doesn't go away. It just mutates every couple of years. So there's a couple of different versions, but they all involve a group of children that have these giant oversized heads, hence the Melon Heads. And depending what story or what version you've heard, they are either born like that and then sent to like an orphanage or a house out in the woods, which is right around, it moves around, but it's kind of like in the Kirtland area. So you're kind of up around the Cleveland sort of area of Ohio. But they're either sent out there because of their heads. And in that particular version, they meet a very nice doctor, Dr. Crowe, C-R-O-W-E, who cares for them. In the alternate version, they are orphans, and it's an orphanage in the woods. And Dr. Crowe actually does these experiments on them to make their heads swell up. In the good Dr. Crowe version, he passes away, and the Melon Heads are forced to kind of wander the woods. And if you drive down these certain roads at night, you are supposed to see these sort of creatures with big heads, and they'll just kind of stand alongside of the road. In the evil Dr. Crowe version, the children in the orphanage were kept in chains. They break out of their chains. They kill the doctor. They burn the orphanage down. And in that version, if you go down those same roads at night, they will come rushing at your car and jump on the car and try to get inside of it. So you've got good Melon Heads and bad Melon Heads. But I've never seen one. I've been up and down those roads, I don't know how many times. And I've spoken to dozens upon dozens of teenagers, some who are no longer teenagers, that have all gone down there looking for it. None of them have actually ever reported seeing it. But they will all tell you that story.
So it's just an urban legend then at this point.
Yeah, it basically seems like there's a lot of legend tripping that is involved with that particular story. But the interesting thing is that there is a tombstone-like object that is somewhat near one of the roads that just simply has the words Dr. Crowe on it. It looks like it might have been at one point a property mark. It's tombstone shaped, but there are no records of anybody actually buried there, and I've never been able to find the actual Dr. Crowe. The fascinating thing about that, though, is, as I said, there's Melon Head stories in Michigan and Connecticut. Neither one of them have a Dr. Crowe aspect to it. So again, it's kind of like this general story that kind of found a home out there that I think, based on my research, is simply because of that tombstone-like object with the name on it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I notice on your Ghosts of Ohio page, you have a section on lore and legends.
Yes.
And you divide these stories up into different categories here. You want to explain this a little?
Yeah. Whenever you get into the different ghost stories, I mean, I've always been willing to admit, and I kind of get in trouble sometimes at sort of ghost conventions that I'm speaking at, because I willingly admit that I don't know what a ghost is. I believe they exist, and I know they do, but what they're capable of or how they do the things that people attribute to them, I don't know how that works, you know, and further, I don't think anybody knows with 100% certainty. Until we can put one in a jar and poke it and figure that out, I think all we have are theories. And I think that to be taken seriously as a researcher, I think that I personally have to be willing to admit that, yeah, I believe in ghosts, but I also think that there are, you know, there is a lot of BS that's out there, and there's a lot of stuff that can't be proven. And so because of that, we started to almost, I don't want to say rank the stories, but yeah, we kind of put little caveats onto some of the stories, especially the ones, I think it's called the hard to believe section, which are the ones that we're like, okay, so many people have told us this story that it should go on here because it is something that, you know, generations have actually grown up with. But when you come right down to it, there's no way that this story is probably true.
Yeah, vicious rumors is what you have.
Vicious rumors. There you go. Okay. Yeah, I mean, because it's interesting. And another interesting side note is one of the biggest offshoots that went from the Ghosts of Ohio page to the Strange and Spooky World site is the idea of a crybaby bridge. And yeah, I was fascinated with those when I was growing up in New York. There was one near the little town that I grew up in, and that was the crybaby bridge, you know. And I mean, it was the basic story about a woman, you know, she threw her baby off the side of the bridge, and if you went there back then, it was Halloween at midnight, and you flashed your lights three times, you could hear the baby cry. And I grew up believing that was the story. And then I moved to Atlanta, and there were three of them down there, almost identical stories. And I was like, well, what's going on here? Well, when I moved to Ohio, I'm actually up to almost 50 crybaby bridges in Ohio alone. And I decided, because people kept telling me, whenever I put one up on the Ghosts of Ohio site, they were like, well, you think that story is BS. That's because that's not the real crybaby bridge. The real crybaby bridge is here. And they would tell the same story, but a different bridge. And so I got the neat idea. I'm like, I got to start cataloging these things. So that's what I started doing on Strange and Spooky World. And I think I probably got close to 20 of them up there so far, which is basically the location of the bridge, the story behind the bridge, what we call the ritual, which is kind of like what you're supposed to do to see the ghost. And then we will go into any history of the bridge. What I'm looking for, not just in Ohio, but I've yet to find it, is the crybaby bridge. You know, did someone actually throw a child off the bridge, or there an accident that killed the child that led to these stories? And I haven't found that yet in Ohio. But interestingly enough, what I have found is a few of the stories, or a few of the bridges, you could say might be haunted, because there have been murders. There have been bodies dumped on these bridges. And we put all that information up there when we do find it. And there's even one bridge that had an unsolved murder on the bridge. So it's kind of an interesting thing, again, going back to where you've got history and sort of folklore slamming into each other.
Yeah. Tell me about the Gore Orphanage.
Ah.
there's a band I know from Ohio, a thrash band, who actually wrote a song called Gore Orphanage, and I didn't realize it was actually related to something.
Oh, there you go. I got to go track that down now and see. I mean, do they sing about an orphanage?
The song's called Gore Orphanage.
Yeah. Huh. I'll have to check that. Yeah, Gore Orphanage probably ranks right up there in terms of ghost stories and urban legends. It's got to be in like at least the top three in Ohio. And the vast majority of it is brought about by the fact that you can probably punch that into MapQuest, Gore Orphanage Road, and it exists. And the story behind Gore Orphanage, to kind of just encapsulate it a little bit, is that there was an orphanage on Gore Orphanage Road, and something happens that causes the building to burn down. Again, there is in the one where the owners of the orphanage are nice, it is just an accident where a kid knocks over a lantern or something like that. And there's also a variant in which the owners are kind of evil, and they don't want to run an orphanage anymore, so they lock all the doors and they burn the kids to death inside of it. But either way, if you go out into the field off of Gore Orphanage Road, in amongst all these trees, you will find a stone sort of foundation, which they say is the foundation of the Gore Orphanage. And that if you park your car there, then walk into the ruins and you spend some time there, if you're lucky, you might hear the sounds of children screaming. You might hear doors slamming. People have reported hearing the sounds of fire. Others have reported seeing the ghosts of children who look like they're on fire running through the woods. And then after all that time, when you make your way back to the car, you're supposed to find little children's handprints in the all over the car, as if they were children trying to get inside of the car. That's the basic urban legend, long-standing urban legend. Again, when I start digging into the history, I find that most of that story is not true, but I find that what is to me even more fascinating things, because for one, there was an orphanage on that road. It was not called Gore, though. It was called the Orphanage of Light and Hope. it was a very nice orphanage. The interesting thing is that a gore is actually a term, a surveyor's term. And basically, in the old days, when the surveyors would go out, you know, they'd have to put the sticks up and mark everything down. When they went back and actually applied all their stuff to the maps, if there was a little section that kind of was between the two properties that they kind of missed, they called that a gore. And so what they did is the gore would have to be dedicated to one property or the other. So that particular gore that they found on that road went to the orphanage. So that's where you got the Gore Orphanage part. The road went right past it. So that's where Gore Orphanage Road came from.
All right.
But to me, the really cool thing is that people who are going out to the foundation are not in the right place where that wasn't the orphanage. They're actually on the wrong side. Ironically, they have to cross over the Crybaby Bridge to get there, but that's another story entirely. But they're on the wrong side of the road, and they're probably almost about a mile or so away from where the orphanage once stood. The orphanage did burn down, but it was long after it had shut down, so there was nobody inside of it. But here comes the really cool twisted part. Where they are going is the ruins of the Swift Mansion, they used to call it, which was a man named Swift. There we go. Ohio not being creative. He actually built this mansion. He, in turn, when he moved out, he sold it to the Wilbur family. The Wilbur family, unfortunately, had four children pass away in that house in the early 1900s from the cholera epidemic that swept through the area. Those four children died within a year of each other. It has been recorded that, and it sounds a little weird, but not really for the time, that the Wilbur family conducted seances in the house to try to contact the children. Again, that was kind of, everybody was doing it back then. You know, it was like the parlor games kind of thing. But to me, I find it fascinating that, you know, on the one hand, you could say, okay, story is total BS because no kids died there. You know, they weren't burning, they weren't doing this. But yet, you know, you're not even in the right place for the orphanage. But yet, they are in a place where children did die. And that we have records that people were actively trying to communicate with them. So maybe they're not the Gore children, but could they be, you know, the Wilbur children that are actually out there?
Huh. Interesting.
I never knew all any of this stuff was in Ohio when I first moved here. You know, the joke was that when I asked people, I'm moving to Ohio, what can you tell me about it? And I actually wrote this in the beginning of Weird Ohio because the only thing people said was, I think a lot of people drive through Ohio. And I was like, yeah, that's not real. But it's just fascinating. In all the different states I've lived in, Ohio is somewhat unique in that they have so many different, very unique ghost stories and urban legends attached to them. You know, I mean, obviously they've got the crybaby bridges, but there's just a lot of stories that you're like, wow, I've never heard anything like that before.
Well, why don't you give us one of your favorites?
There's a lot of them. I mean, My personal favorite that I like to point out, which is in Ohio, it's not necessarily even a ghost story, but I just think it's kind of neat, is that Ohio is home to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is meant nothing to me when I moved here until I started realizing that way too many UFO things came out of Wright-Patt for it to be a coincidence. The infamous Project Blue Book originated and came out of Wright-Patt. Regardless of whether you believe that UFOs crashed in Roswell, or it was, you know, it's fairly well documented that something did crash in Roswell. Whatever right. crashed, there are declassified records that whatever that debris was came to Wright-Patterson in Dayton, Ohio. That was brought there. The whole legend was that it was Hangar 18. There's all this mythos around the legendary Hangar 18.
Right,
That's from Wright-Patterson in the airfield. Kecksburg is another famous UFO thing from Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, where hundreds of people saw this UFO crash and saw people pull it out, you know, on a flatbed truck. That the Army military went down there and pulled this out. Well, that truck came to Wright-Patterson. So so basically, if you go back and look at any of the major UFO events, if you will, if there was debris recovered, it went to Wright-Patt. Now, part of that is because Wright-Patt has an entire division, if you will, that their job since at least World War II, but probably even before that, their job was to basically reverse engineer, and this word is always in quotes, alien technology. So basically, if something fell out of the sky and we didn't know what it was, it went there to so that our government could put it, try to put it back together and figure out what it was. So it would make sense if it was, you know, during World War II, if, you know, some Japanese technology or something fell from the sky, it would go out there. But if it came from Mars or something like that, it was still going to go to Wright-Patt for them right. to look at it. So so that's something that, again, I've just always found really, really interesting. Mothman is another interesting thing because a lot of people equate the Mothman sightings with Point Pleasant. With the Silver Bridge. But what I started finding out is that when Mothman started showing up in Point Pleasant, the vast that almost immediately after that, there was an entire rash of UFO reports right across the river, which is, you know, right along Ohio, Gallipolis, Ohio, which is right at that border with the Silver Bridge that crosses it. The whole idea that the Mothman caused the bridge to crash at that particular time and killed those people, the vast majority of people who perished on there were from Ohio. So there's just another weird Ohio. There you go, weird Ohio. That plug, I didn't even mean to do that. But there's just a lot of interesting Mothman connections that are part of Ohio, even though when most people think about it, you know, it's Point Pleasant, it's West Virginia, it's across the line there. Go ahead, sorry, I think I was stepping on you there.
No, you weren't. Uh-oh. No, that's interesting. How about one of your favorite ghost stories? Because we haven't dealt much with ghosts.
I think my favorite ghost stories, I mean, I would think the one that I keep going back to, and it's probably the one, here, I'll give you a famous one and then one that's like not as well-known. But the big one that I really love is the Mansfield Reformatory. It's in Mansfield, but it's amazing. It's an old prison that I tell people the easiest way, if you want to see the inside of it, is rent Shawshank Redemption, because the vast majority of that movie was filmed inside that prison, including a lot of the things that don't, you wouldn't think were part of the prison. The halfway house where they write, you know, Brooks was here, so was Red. That was actually filmed at the prison as well, because the front of the prison itself is four stories two separate wings, and that was the warden's quarters because he lived out there with his family. The prison itself has got the world's tallest freestanding cell block, which is 6 stories tall. It's just an immense, immense structure. And what we do is every other year, we go out there and we basically rent the building out for the night. We have a program called Spend the Night with the Ghosts of Ohio. And all people need to do is sign up for our free newsletter, which we send out every other month. And if we randomly pull your email off of that, you can get locked inside a building overnight with us. So Mansfield is a big enough place where you can kind of spread out. And they'll lock us in from, I guess, 7 or 8 p.m. until I think it's like 6 a.m. And it's we take roughly about 25 people tops, and we'll break into groups of 3 or 4, and then we'll say, okay, you know what? Your group, you're in solitary for the next 45 minutes. You guys are here. And we do that because, well, it's spookier that way. But we also do that because, you know, that little group of 3 or 4 can go anywhere they want, but they have to stay in that area. And we do that because we want people to know if you're sitting in a cell, the 3 or 4 of you, and you hear something walking up above you, there shouldn't be anybody in that bit up above you. So it kind of helps you figure out, okay, what's going on there. That being said, I defy anybody to go into that prison and not feel something. It is just so overwhelmingly depressing to know the conditions that these guys unfortunately lived in. But that being said, it is a very common thing for, I've encountered this numerous times, and we can't find any explanation, but you'll be walking down the cell block and it's nothing, you know, it's dark. And, you know, we've got lights that we put in there. We'll be looking through the infrared or the thermals or those sort of things. And many, many people have reported, and I've seen this, what appears to be a figure of a person peek their head and sometimes the top half of their body out from inside of the cell and then pull back in. Hmm. And I've been doing this so long that I never run away from it. I run at it now. And you go down there and there's nothing there. And there's no way, because if it were to run the other way, it's going to go into the wall. I think one of the oddest things that we ever got is a group of us were down in solitary confinement. And it's basically a little loop that you can make. And they were all sitting in the middle, and it suddenly just felt weird. It felt as if something or someone new had kind of entered the area. And all the equipment that we had, basically the EMFs and those sort of things, just started screeching for a couple of seconds. And then it felt like something just like went by and it went away. And a couple of minutes later, you could feel it like it was coming back again. The equipment all started going crazy again, and then it was gone. And it appeared as, you know, almost as if, this sounds bizarre, but, you know, like someone was making the rounds, like going in a circle. And we found out later that one of the solid guards was actually killed very close to where we were. He was actually making the rounds, and two of the guys had actually gotten out and were waiting for him and basically clubbed him to death and then tried to escape. So that was kind of interesting in a weird kind of way. But I have to say the oddest thing that we've ever gotten at Mansfield is we had 3 women and they were up in a cell block all by themselves. And we had this, it's called like an ELF meter, which is like an EMF, but it's got a red light, a yellow light, and a green light that basically just lets you know if the levels are going too high, that the electromagnetic fields. And about halfway through their session, it was showing green the whole thing, and it started to flicker to yellow. And one of the girls, it was her first investigation, she said, "Is it okay if it goes to yellow?" And one of the other girls, being rather sarcastic, said, "Yes, as long as it's not the danger, Will Robinson," because the red light says danger on it. When we play that back, you hear a man laughing right after she says Will Robinson, and it's laughing so loud that you can hear it echoing. There was nobody else. There was no man, let alone anybody else, in that entire cell block. And the really trippy part is what we do with all of our audio is we record them on studio microphones that we hardwire down into mixing boards, because we want to make sure that we're not picking up any stray signals or anything, you know, sucking them out of the ozone or what have you. And then anybody going on an investigation with us, what we do is we stand them prior to it. We stand them in front of a studio microphone. We have them read three sentences from his book. And then we have them whisper the same three sentences, because you're not using your vocal cords when you whisper. And then we back them up 6 foot, same thing, speak, whisper, 12 foot, do it again. And we create a little voice pattern. And then what we do is whenever we hear something on, you know, that we think might be a ghost, we try to compare it to the voice patterns of everybody else. That noise, that laugh, if you will, I can't say it's a ghost. I can only tell you that it falls within the range of a human voice, and it doesn't match the imprint of any other person that was in the building at that time.
Now, did they actually hear the laugh?
They did not. No, they did not.
But yet it echoes.
Yeah, it echoes. And it's funny because I play it at presentations, and the interesting thing is I always tell people I'm not the kind of guy that says, you know, if you close one eye and squint the other, this kind of looks like the ghost of Abe Lincoln. You know, I'm kind of like, if you can't hear it, you know, don't tell me what it says, because if you're telling me and then you're going to play, I'm going to hear it because you told me what.
Right.
So when I tell people, listen, and you're going to hear something, and if you don't hear it, let me know, because you got to get your ears checked. And people are just like, what the? Because it is just so loud. It is as loud, if not louder, than the girls who were speaking. And as I said, yeah, you can hear it reverberating.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, but real quick, give people your websites.
The Ghosts of Ohio website is ghostsofohio.org, and the Strange and Spooky World is strangeandspookyworld.com.
All right, we'll be right back with James Willis.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we're talking with James Willis here on Where Did the Road Go tonight, and you are based in Ohio, and you've been doing a bunch of ghost work out there. What kind of equipment do you use when you do ghost hunts?
It's a great question, because we kind of run the gamut, and as I said, I've been kind of, I was going to say using my equipment, but that wasn't going to sound right, but I already said it, so what the heck. But I mean, I've been using different forms of equipment since the 80s. It's kind of funny how the very first pieces of equipment that I was using were, you know, like 35 millimeter and Polaroids, and I've actually still got my old reel-to-reel recorder that I used to use. And we will still pull those out every once in a while just to see. But our equipment tends to run the gamut of things. We have got all of the bells and whistles with, you know, EMF detectors, infrared thermometers. We have a FLIR, a thermal camera, I'm trying to think of even that one. I think they call it the X-Cam, but it's basically the one that kind of takes the plot points. And the interesting thing about those is that we will, and it's one of the things that we put into the newsletter I mentioned earlier, is that we get a lot of this equipment and then we test it out. Because let's be honest, this stuff isn't cheap. And a large part of our fan base kind of likes the idea that we will kind of run it through to see if it actually does what it's supposed to do to, you know, maybe save some people some money. One of the cooler things that I like to use on most investigations is it's a Vernier Lab Pro system, which is basically It's a set of remote sensors and like thermocouples and those sort of things that you would use for, they're designed to be used for high school like science experiments. So you can kind of get instantaneous, well, it's every half second, but you can get fairly instantaneous readings and do plotting on it. So what you can do is you can get, say, a spot thermometer and say, well, how does the temperature of this change when we, you know, set it on fire or something like that. But mm-hmm. what we do is it allows us to create what I kind of call my ghostly tackle box, because we have got roughly about a dozen sensors that we will use based on what the clients are experiencing. So for example, we have got ambient temperature devices where we can, you know, if somebody says, well, we see a ghost of a woman walking up the stairs. Well, we can take a few ambient temperature devices and line them up and down the stairs, then put them into a data logger, and then we actually just use a laptop as sort of a monitor and set it so that we can actually see every half second it takes a reading. So in theory, if something moves up and down those stairs, the temperature could change. Or we can put a whole bunch of EMF detectors on there. We have got static electricity charges. We've got, you know, you name it, we can actually put them through these sensors. So I kind of like that because it allows us to kind of, you know, mix and match as we go along on investigations. You know, that being said, we even have started incorporating back into our investigation things like dowsing rods, pendulums, because at one point I just started thinking to myself, you know, am I so engrossed in all of these gadgets and sitting here staring at these monitors and the infrared cameras with the quad system that I'm staring at all of these images that there could be a ghost behind me dancing around, but I am so focused on the equipment that I'm forgetting to use my own senses. So we'll bounce around a lot and do it because, again, going back to what I said, I don't think anybody has 100% proof as to what a ghost is. So to me, that means we don't have the right piece of equipment yet. We might have equipment that works in certain situations, but we don't have that one really cool one. So I think we need to keep changing and modifying our investigative techniques, you know, until we hit pay dirt.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. What ghosts are? I mean, obviously, the obvious answer is they're spirits of the dead or a recording of something that's happened there.
Yes.
But I would think that they can also sometimes behave as if there's something else mimicking a spirit of the dead.
Yes. And again, I'm willing to admit, I believe that to be true, but I don't know how that works. You know,
right.
I mean, going back to the thing in Mansfield where, you know, the girl made a bad joke, you know, about Danger Will, you know, the Lost in Space thing, and then the ghost of a man laughed. Well, I believe that was a ghost, but that means that I've got to try to figure out, well, does that means that, okay, clearly you take your ghostly vocal cords with you, you know, when you go to the other side, but does that mean that he was just hanging out there? Now, clearly he has to have ghost ears or a ghost, you know, he's got to have something that he actually, if that's indeed what happened, which it seemed like he was laughing in response to what she said. But
right.
to put all those things into that area kind of blows my mind a little bit. But yet that's what it appears like, you know, to me, that it was laughing in response to something that she said.
And real quick, we're going to play you that clip of the laugh from Mansfield.
So have you caught anything interesting using the X cams?
It's kind of cool because while we haven't actually caught anything with it, I'm proud to say that the X cam does actually work, as it were. I mean, what we do is when we get any new piece of equipment, we kind of take it apart and try to figure out how it works and what it's designed to do. And we found that the X cam, we tried seeing if it was trying to pick up heat signatures, like what it was doing. The X-Cam, the technology that's in there, is basically designed that anything it sees in its line of sight, to turn that into a person. So we found that if we were kind of just taking it and just moving around inside of a room, that anytime it came across like a coat rack or anything that was vertical, it immediately tried to like put arms and legs on it. So we were like, okay, maybe that's why a lot of these things on these shows where the people are just running around with the cameras, there's all these like figures that are like up in the sky and doing things like that. But what we did is once we locked it down, we put it on a tripod and we locked the thing down, it stopped. It kind of settled down and it was kind of like, okay, let me calm down. I know what all these things are. And then we didn't get any of those kind of like false anomalies. Then as people, we would walk back and forth. And as soon as we did, it would lock onto us and it would totally turn us into person. We tried that with my 5-year-old daughter. It even actually did a our cats. It turned them into, now it tried to make them like people crawling on the floor, but it did pick them up and track them. So we find that it's kind of cool because what we will do is we will take it on investigations and we will kind of lock it down, let it calm down, and then kind of record off of that. And while we haven't gotten anything yet, I'm really excited for when the day that if we do get something where it's walking like that, because we've kind of figured out that if it does do that, there's probably something ghostly out there.
Hmm. Okay. Is there any equipment that you found that absolutely doesn't work?
Yeah. I don't know if I want to get people in trouble for it. Yeah, there's a lot of the ghost boxes, spirit boxes, those sort of things, that they're not. I'm not saying that, I guess I shouldn't say that I know 100% that they don't work. I just know that you really can't take anything that those things are doing as actual ghost evidence, because you don't, for one, they're radio receivers. So by their very instinct, you can't ever have like a control, because the thing is designed to receive. So you can't ever say where the signal is actually originating from. Now, I know a lot of the Frank's boxes that they have out there are nothing more than radios that they've clipped the auto-tune on. So you get that as it's scanning through stations. And a lot of them will tell you that you need to put it on the AM frequencies because that's where the ghost can come through. No, it's because the AM frequencies are when you hear the, you're getting the DJ talking, as you know, because you're getting 2 seconds, if you will, of the AM radio stations. If you had it on FM, you were going to get 2 to 3 seconds of like Stairway to Heaven or something like that and instantly recognize it as music. But you're more inclined to get on the AM stations, pick up voices. So, you know, there are people that say that you know, you've got to flip it. There are ones out there now that will actually play the audio backwards. And to me, I'm not saying that doesn't work. I'm just saying, I think there are too many variables that you're throwing into the mix to be able to say that that's something that can be taken, you know, as evidence, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you're twisting it around so much to make it be what you want it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. My personal belief, and again, I always say, put yourself in the ghost shoes, because to me, and this, I mean, I kind of make light of it, but I'm also being very serious. If I'm a ghost and I have been, you know, trying to communicate with someone for years and years, you know, and I finally read, you know, Beetlejuice's Guide for the Recently Deceased, and I know how to do it, and they plunk down this device in front of me, and I'm able to finally speak. After all these years, I'm going to go, you know, I mean, no, I'm going to scream my name. I'm a ghost. I died here. You know, I'm going to say something so that people know who I am. But yet these people will get these things that they claim are EVPs. And I'm like, if you got to work that hard for it, and I'm not talking about just like cleaning it up, but I'm like, people say, well, if you know, you scrub it and you turn this and they start playing it where it sounds like they're running it through auto tune almost.
Yeah.
I really can't take that. I think those are going to become, you know, sort of wishful thinking.
And it could be something that didn't pick up very well,
yes,
but you prove that because there's not enough there.
Exactly. And along those lines, what we do for the investigations that the Ghosts of Ohio do, when we go out to a private individual's home or their place of business, and we sit down with them and we show them what we got, you know, the audio, the video, those sort of things, we never call it a ghost. Because to me, I wholeheartedly believe that an encounter with a ghost is a very personal thing. in that if you experience it firsthand, you know it was a ghost. You know it. You were there. You know what you experienced. You try to explain that to 10 people, 5 are going to think you're nuts right off the bat. 3 will believe you, but that's just because, like, you know, you're related or something. And then the other 2 will really believe you. But it's not until those skeptics or the people that don't believe have that personal experience themselves that they're going to know, really, that they saw a ghost. So we won't ever say, hey, this is a ghost. We'll just say, here's what we got. We can't explain it. And then if to them it's a ghost, fine. If to them it's not a ghost, totally fine. But it's their house, so it should be their evidence. And, you know, they get to decide whether or not that's a ghost. Because some people, just a little knock is going to be a ghost. Other people have to see, you know, a ghost sitting down and, you know, enjoying a fine cigar with you before they believe.
Right. There's also such a trickster element to everything paranormal that it also leads me away from thinking that these are simply explained as things like ghosts.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Because like you said, if they want to communicate, why are they playing games?
Correct. And I think part of that, you could say, like you said, I totally believe that there are things disguising themselves as something else or being, like you said, like a trickster. But the flip side of that is also, you know, part of me thinks that if I could come back as a ghost, I'd mess with some people's heads. You know, there's a cartoon that somebody sent me years ago, and I had it hanging up in my office for the longest time, and then I lost it. But it was like, the caption was, when ghosts mess with the living. And there's 2 ghosts that are talking, and the one ghost goes, so check this out. It asked me if I was there, could I make a sound? So I knocked, and they asked me to make it again, and I didn't. So, you know, I mean, I think there is something to the idea that maybe ghosts just like messing with us, you know?
True.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's sort of an archetype behind that trickster sort of phenomena, too.
Yes.
You know, you see the same type of behavior on so many different cases, and not everyone has the same sense of humor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It would be like if we all had the same sense of humor and we're all telling the same jokes, and, you know, that just doesn't happen.
Right, right. No, it's a good point.
So why would it happen in the paranormal field?
True.
I mean, not that it can't be a dead person with a sense of humor. I'm sure that is a possibility. I mean, it's also possible that we're bleeding over from another dimension somewhere.
Yes. Yeah, and that's where you start getting into what I call the 2-bottle conversations, because you need, like, 2 bottles of really good wine to start digging into that. But you're exactly right, because, I mean, I think if ghosts were as simple as that cut and dried sort of, okay, they're the spirits of those who have passed on, or they're that residual energy, I think if it were that simple, we would have figured it out a long time ago. But I you know, the whole idea about why are you seeing this ghost that seems to be interacting with you, but it's dressed in period clothes, you know, so then you get into the idea, is this coming through a portal? Is this a time slip? You know, what is going on here? So you're exactly right. I think there are so many layers. And that's one of the things that, again, gets me so excited about this field, but also gets me so frustrated, is what is so exciting to me about all this weird stuff that I'm into is we don't have the answers. So that thrill of the chase is everywhere. But yet you've got these shows and certain people and groups that want to believe they've got all the answers. And I'm like, you don't, and I'm really glad you don't, because life would be boring if you did. But, but, you know, explain this to me. If you really have all the answers, explain this. And that's usually when it falls apart and, you know, they don't want to talk to me anymore.
So tell us a little bit about your latest book.
My latest book, which came out late last year, is called Ohio's Historic Haunts. And for me, it was kind of the book I always wanted to write. And interestingly enough, I was approached by Kent State University, and they said, you know, we're thinking about putting out a ghost book, but, you know, it would have to be something that kind of was scholarly and, you know, all that kind of, you know, university sort of stuff. So do you have any ideas? And the idea that I had, which they kind of jumped all over, is that I firmly believe that ghosts and ghost stories are part of our history. You know, in that, you know, if somebody tells you a ghost story and they say, you know, that was old man Willis's house, you know, and he built it in 42 and he used to smoke a pipe. And when he died, you know, people used to see him walking around on the porch. He was like 6'4". He used to wear a hat, you know, smoke cherry tobacco. To me, once you hear that story, even if you can't verify that ghost exists, you have actual history. You now know even how tall he was, the kind of tobacco he smoked. And so I've always felt that the two were connected, history and ghost lore, if you will. And so for the book, what I did was I I ended up with 21 historically significant locations in Ohio that had a reputation for being haunted. And what I did was I broke the book, each one of the chapters. So each location gets its own chapter. I broke each chapter into thirds, with the first third being just straight ahead history. Who built it, when it was built, what it functioned as, those sort of things. The second third of each chapter were the ghost stories. But again, I did something rather unique in that I didn't rely on second or third generation stories. What I did is I sat down with the owners, the employees, those sort of people, and did one-on-one interviews. I think I ended up with 220 hours worth of one-on-one interviews. What the reason I did it that way, which to be honest was a bear to then have to go back and transcribe it, but I wanted to be able to tell anyone who read the book that, you know what, when it comes to these ghost stories, I sat across the table from these people, looked them dead in the eye, and never called BS on them. I can't tell you they really did see a ghost, but I can tell you I looked them in the eye and they believe they did. And I think that, again, strengthens the idea of this, the idea of a ghost story being a little something more than just a campfire tale. And then the cool part, the coolest part was then the last third of each chapter, I got locked inside of the buildings overnight with all the fancy equipment to see if I could have, you know, my own ghost experience. And if I did, great. If I didn't, great. It wasn't like I was looking to end each chapter with sort of like a haunted or not haunted stamp on it. It was more to just sort of put the ghostly cherry on things, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and plus going into a place one night doesn't prove or disprove that it was that haunted activity happened at another time.
Exactly. And for that reason, I referred to them as vigils. I didn't call them hunts or investigations because you're exactly right. I mean, you're talking about maybe 10 or 12 hours inside of a building. You know, it's kind of ghostly fishing, I refer to it as. You know, you can sometimes pull into a fully stocked lake and not get a nibble. It doesn't mean the fish aren't there. They're just not biting. So it's kind of like ghostly fishing.
What's one of the creepiest things that's happened to you on a ghost hunt?
The one, and I think this will kind of tie a lot of the things we've been talking about together. The one thing that's happened to me, and it's interesting because when it happened to me, I wasn't that weirded out by it. But I recently started telling this story again. And as I did, I looked at like the people and they were staring at me like, that is the creepiest thing I've ever heard. And now the more I think about it, it creeps me out to the point where it's kept me up some nights. So if you or any of your listeners can explain the story I'm going to tell here, please, you know, let me know because it'll help me sleep better. But Waverly Hills is a very famous or infamous, it's an old TB hospital, and it had been covered on numerous shows, you know, right. I know as being haunted. And the interesting thing is that when Ghost Adventures were there, they added like a new wrinkle. There was a new ghost that they called the Creeper. And what the Creeper would do was it was this like human form, but it was just a black shadow. You couldn't really make any features. And it crawled around on its hands and knees on the ceiling. And that was usually up on the fourth floor. That was also the area where people would report seeing what they would call like a doppelganger, in that people would be walking on the fourth floor and, you know, let's just say we're walking with, I don't know, a girl named Judy, and the three of us are walking down the hallway, and all of a sudden we look into a room and Judy's standing there, and we're like, what are you doing in there? And we go in the room to see where she is, and she's not in there anymore, and we find out that she'd actually gone downstairs. So people are seeing ghostly doubles, if you will, of people throughout the building. So they said that if you wanted the chance to see the Creeper, what you should do is go up to the fourth floor and one person stand at the end of the hallway, and then the other rest of the group go kind of halfway down the other end of the hallway, face the person who's standing alone, and turn out all the lights, and that eventually the group of people will see the creeper come creeping up behind the person who's standing alone. So I was like, okay, I'll go be the bait. I don't care, you know, because it's what I'm here for. So let's see. So there were four of us, myself, and I won't name the other people for reasons that will become apparent shortly, but there were the group of three that were going to watch me. There were two guys and a girl. So what we did is I figured out, and we're in this hallway, and it's an old TB hospital. So basically you're looking down the hallway, and it's just like patient rooms. So it's just doors on the left and right hand side, long hallway, straight too. So they go down the hallway about midway, and I go almost all the way down to like the other end. They can still see me. And I've got an infrared video camera in my hand, and then I've got a headlamp on. And so they get down there, and I'm like, okay, can you see me? And they can see me and stuff. So what I did was I bent down. I put the camera, it was still on, the camera down between my legs, but like shooting up from the floor down towards them. And I stood up, and I turned off my headlamp and basically stood there in total darkness. After, you know, I'm sitting there, I don't feel anything weird. You know, I can barely see them, you know, in the darkness and stuff. But they say that they can see, you know, my shadows. So we're just sitting there or standing there, being really quiet. I'm not feeling anything. There's absolutely nothing going on. And then, you know, I'm just kind of just standing there, arms crossed. And then I hear the one guy go, "Where did he go?" And the girl said, "I think he went in that room." And they're talking to themselves. And then the other guy goes, "Jim?" And I said, "Yeah." And then I heard the G-rated version, "Oh, blank, that wasn't him." And I said, "What is going on?" So now comes the part I need people to explain to me. Two of them, one of the guys and one of the girls, told me and swear to this day, and they told me independently and have told everybody else, that this is exactly what they both saw. The other guy claimed he didn't see any of this, but he strangely enough left the group shortly after, so everybody is convinced he saw this too. But they said that for the first 20 minutes or so, the three of them just saw me standing there in the darkness, doing absolutely nothing. They then saw me turn on my headlamp so that my entire body was now illuminated. I bent down, picked up the camera, turned to my left, and walked into the room that was to my left, leaving behind the darkness. I never moved. And the weird thing is that where the "oh blank, that wasn't him" is, they said, because here's the part that's weird, that, see, I'm getting freaked out now that I'm even telling the story again. Where did I go? That's what's scary, because they said that when I turned the headlamp on, that they could see me. You know, it was my, because the weird thing is, I have the headlamp is like on a swivel, and I normally put the swivel down so it illuminates the ground, and also so I don't blind people when I turn it on. So they said that when I turned it on, my entire body lit up. They saw me with my hands reach down, pick up my camera, and turn and walk out and take the light with me, if you will, leaving the dark hallway. But what they, so I said, "Well, when did I just pop? Did you suddenly see me again?" And they said, "We don't know how you got back," but they both said, and I'm going to paraphrase what they were saying to, you know, put a collective story in there, but they both said that they watched me walk into that room, and they both were just like, "Okay, he's bored. We're not going to do this anymore." And that when they said, "Jim," they were looking where I had gone into, thinking my reply was going to come from out of that room, if that makes sense. So when they, so they were kind of looking to their right. They weren't looking at where I was in the hallway, but they were looking to the right where the door was. When they heard my voice go, "Yeah," from the middle of the hallway, they looked back, and at that point they could still see my shadow. So I was back in the hallway. But I don't know where I went. And that, like, when it first happened to me, like, you know, because when they told me later, I was like, "Man, that's weird." But the more I think about it, it's just, again, did I go into an, you know, the, I don't know. I'm getting speechless, which never happens, but it just weirds me out. Cause I'm like, cause I didn't feel any different. I didn't feel like I had blacked out. I didn't feel, you know, there wasn't any sort of time slip or anything that took place there. I didn't feel any different. I didn't have any ectoplasmic goo on me or anything. So I don't know what happened, what it was.
But I would wonder if it was something that affected them, not you.
We've talked about that. Yeah.
Affected their consciousness and you were completely untouched.
And see, we talked about that. And then where we all started getting freaked out is like, if that were true and that did happen, what was the point of it? What was the point of any of that?
Well, and I've had an experience I don't know if I've talked about it on this show. I know I've talked about it on other shows where three of us were standing at the edge of this graveyard and we were watching this tree just shake. And I thought there was like a buck or something on the other side, uh-huh. like shoving its antlers into the tree.
Right.
And you could feel it like jumping up and down on the ground, but you couldn't see through the bushes and stuff. And when I walked around to see what was doing it, it immediately stopped and there was nothing in the field on the other side. And when I walked back, it started doing it again. And my one friend was losing his mind. He was freaking out because this was obviously not a normal thing.
Right.
My other friend was freaking out because to him, the tree wasn't moving.
Really?
And I sat there and we both looked at him, just kind of went quiet, went, what? And he's like, yeah, what are you guys? And he's like freaking out because obviously there's something going on, but he's not seeing it. And it at that point, I'm thinking, all right, what's really going on now?
That's wild.
You know, is it that we don't all see reality the same way? Does our brain block things out? Can some stuff appear to us differently than it does to other people?
Yeah.
And that's what it reminds me of when you say the one guy said he didn't see anything.
Yeah. I mean, that personally, I think is a little different. Because like I said, he left the group shortly after that and he never really gave a good example, but it could still have been that he really didn't see anything, but just the idea that something like that was happening was enough to freak him out. We just assumed that he did see it and that whole thing freaked him out. But no, I mean, it does sound similar though.
Or it freaked him out because he didn't see
it. Yeah.
You know, how could these two people standing right next to him see such a clear thing? I mean, the fact that your light came on, it wasn't just like a shadow.
Right. And we even went back to see if it was some weird kind of thing where, for however it happened, that their mind was actually replaying something that I had done earlier in that evening. But I had not been in that room at all. We went into that room later in the evening, but it's not like there was ever an instance where I was standing, you know, put my light on and then had gone into that room. So, yeah, we've never been able to figure out what happened with that.
I would also wonder if they're just standing there staring at you for 20 minutes, if it may have been something that allowed an altered state of consciousness to occur easily.
See, we considered that too. The only part where it gets a little weird is that because you've got, I mean, I am really out of my league when I started talking about that, but it's almost as that if they did do that, that altered state allowed them to see the same exact thing. So that's where, again, it gets into that two bottle conversation. But yeah, something went on, you know, and, you know, that night there was also later in the, I mean, there were a lot of rainstorms that were coming through the area. There were some very, very cool thunder and lightning storms that came through the area. So we were like, was there just something literally in the air that just allowed, it was the perfect storm, if you will, that allowed all these conditions to be just right to have this, I don't want to call it a hallucination, but you know what?
This experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I assume nothing was being recorded at the time.
Not with their cameras. You don't see anything, which is totally weird because you don't see any light go on or anything like that. You can barely make out my shadow, so it's kind of inconclusive. My camera, right. I mean, you've got all the audio on it and you've got all the audio coming out of my camera, which if nothing else, all it does is really verify that I didn't walk away or pick the camera up, but it was just pointing down the hallway towards them.
Yeah, man, it's almost like something affected their consciousness, something to them, and showed them something, you know, in that tricksterish sort of way.
Yeah, I like that explanation better, because then nothing was messing with me. It was them.
Well, that definitely counts as a creepy experience.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Where can people find your books?
Probably the easiest way is any of the online retailers. I mean, they're all on Amazon if they are in state. So if they're in Ohio, you can find them in all the brick and mortar sort of Barnes and Noble, those sort of things. You know, if they're in Indiana, they get the Indiana ones. But the easiest is probably just to, you know, head on over to Amazon, because they've got them all in stock. You can get them through my site as well, but it's not like they're anything special or anything like that. I haven't yet figured out, because people are like, well, can you sign them for me? And we haven't really quite figured out the logistics with the Postal Service on that. So I would say you can get them anywhere. If you type them in or type my name in, you're going to eventually hit them.
All right. And your two websites again?
The ghost site is ghostsofohio.org, and the strange and spooky stuff is at strangeandspookyworld.com.
All right. And is there anything you have coming up?
I am going to be in Steubenville this coming Monday for President's Day. I'm doing a special presentation, The Strange and Spooky Side of Abraham Lincoln. So if people are in that area, it's well worth it. It's free. And it's just basically, again, doing what we've been talking about earlier, just kind of pulling apart the historical facts from the fictions with Abraham Lincoln. With there are tons of stories about him, everything from seances in the White House to predicting his own death to on the anniversary of the funeral train when it came through the area. People report seeing the funeral train go through. So all sorts of strange and spooky stuff associated with him. And then I think that's it for a little bit. Usually what happens is in the springtime, I start kind of touring around Ohio in the Midwest, giving sort of presentations. And then when it rolls around into October, that's when it hits really big. But you can pick all that stuff up on Strange and Spooky World or the Ghosts of Ohio website. We've got calendars there, and we're all over Facebook and that kind of stuff. The interesting thing is how I got started on this years ago. If you type James Willis and Weird in or something like that, or even Weird Ohio, Weird Willis, you're going to get me, and you'll have many rabbit holes to fall down.
Do you have any video clips up anywhere?
We have got a couple that are actually on the Strange and Spooky site as well, okay. On there as well.
All right. And another book in the works at any point?
Yes, I am just, I don't think I'm allowed to speak that openly about it yet, but I have just getting ready to sign the contract on the first of what appears to be a trilogy of Ohio folk tales and urban legends sort of thing, sort of doing legend tripping across the state. And that book, if all goes well, will probably be coming out the first of 2017, with the other two books to follow several months behind that.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, James. And we'll talk to you again.
Yeah, the pleasure was all mine. Yes. Thank you very, very much.
All right. There we go. That was the conversation with James Willis. And I hope you enjoyed it. Check out his websites. There's a lot of stuff there. And, of course, go to our website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. Become a patron, and you'll get all kinds of interesting extras for only $3 a month. And it helps us out. Have a midweek podcast coming this week on David Bowie and his connections to the occult. And during this interview, I spoke of a thrash band that had a song called Gore Orphanage. And I double-checked with them, and they said, go ahead and use the song at the end of the interview. So this is Vindicator from Cleveland, Ohio. They're sort of on hiatus now, but just kind of an old-school thrash band singing about the Gore Orphanage. We'll see you next week.
took too many times. All of your life, the legends will fall. Venturing by night on this cursed road. Of the dead, forsaken children roaming this land. The ruins, the curse of the dead. Forsaken children are roaming the sand.